From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts fishermen are criticizing today's creation of the nation's first Atlantic National Marine Monument.
Where they're fishing is highly profitable with minimal impact, and to go find other areas is going to displace other fishermen.
Also today,
last year, across every age, every race in America, incomes rose and the poverty rate fell.
But Massachusetts wages didn't rise as much as the rest of the country. We'll find out why. And long-absent Chinatown residents return in an evocative new art installation.
What I'm trying to say is Chinatown itself is a home to a lot of people, and it's been here for over 100 years.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
The notion that the ocean I grew up with is not something that I can pass on to my kids and my grandkids is unacceptable. It's unimaginable.
That's President Obama earlier today as he announced the creation of the first national marine monument in the Atlantic Ocean. The Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument sits 130 miles southeast of Cape Cod on the southern edge of Georgia's Bank. It's almost 5,000 square miles, the size of Connecticut, a submerged ecosystem of oceanic canyons, vivid corals, teeming marine wildlife. As a result of today's declaration, oil and gas exploration and drilling are banned in the area, as well as most commercial fishing. That's why many in the New England fishing industry are protesting Obama's executive order today. We'll hear from them in just a moment. But first, the scientific view. Tim Schenck is a scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
So first of all, Mr. Schenck, describe to us a little bit more about the Northeast Canyon Seamount and Seamounts Marine National Monument. What exactly is there that is of such great national value?
Sure, I'd be happy to. These are three canyons are designated in this area, and these are canyons that are about the size or larger than the Grand Canyon. They were formed tens of thousands of years ago when sea level was much lower and rivers cut through the continental shelf. And since that time, they've become submerged. And if you continue off coast to the east from these canyons, you'll run into four mountains that are inside our economic exclusive zone that we have here. And they are mountains that come up about a mile off the seafloor, and they're rugged terrain that you might think of as a mountain terrain. And they have live corals and fish. A variety of ecosystems, sponge ecosystems, that are often found nowhere else on Earth. And these seamounts are very important scientifically because we believe there's places where new species form. These are places that are relatively isolated from other places in the deep sea, and so those animals that live there, the species that live there, may be nowhere else.
Okay, so what effect, if I may ask, does today's declaration then have on our scientific understanding and our future scientific understanding of these ecosystems?
Well, that's a great question because the management plan for how we're going to work inside this monument as scientists has yet to be written, and that'll be shaped in the coming months. Well, what it means, I think, for scientists is that we're getting across to the public now, and the American public and our government is now realizing how important these natural resources are, these coral ecosystems that we have. We don't know that much about them. They'd be very important in terms of disease. They produce a lot of enzymes and proteins. They may be useful in disease, in fine diseases. And they're also very vulnerable, and we need them for fisheries. We have juvenile fish, a variety of species that use these corals as their sanctuaries, as their hatcheries. So scientifically, they're very important to us, And we don't understand much about them. We've only been studying these canyon areas for the last 5 years.
Well, is this the best way to preserve a marine ecosystem like this? And I ask with this specific question in mind. You know, I've heard that this area on the edge of Georgia's Bank has been called a submerged Yellowstone. But when you're talking about terrestrial national parks, you know, those are created in part so that people can go visit them, appreciate the grandeur of nature, right? And really connect with that aspect of the natural wonders in the United States. But most people aren't ever going to go 130 miles off the coast of Cape Cod and actually visit what's under the water there.
Perhaps not yet, but with our growing observatories network that we have in the United States, it may be possible sooner than you think. To be frank with you, just 2 years ago, we were down in these areas, the submerged Yellowstone, if you will, broadcasting live 24 hours a day off the seafloor back onto the internet for anyone to watch and make discoveries along with us. I think it's going to take a while before people realize that they have this link, some of these links on the internet to see these things and make these discoveries in real time with scientists. And so, but I understand your point is that this is a far off place, perhaps, even though it's only 100 miles off our coast, that people don't see every day. And that's an issue that ocean scientists fight all the time, that there are valuable resources down there, things we don't understand yet, that are so important to us. I mean, every other breath we take comes from the plant life living in our ocean, giving us oxygen. But people don't really think about that in their day-to-day life.
Well, one of the reasons why this area is currently so pristine and so valuable, fishermen say that it's because they're currently having a very minimal impact on it. And they are, at this point in time, harvesting fish there and crab in a sustainable way, and that there's no reason for them to be banned from fishing in this area.
Yeah, that may certainly be true. I've seen no data to suggest that it's sustainable or not sustainable in that regard. The fishing typically happens at a much shallower depth at the tops of these canyons. These canyons extend from 400 meters down to 4,000 meters. And normally the fishing is done around 300 to 400 meters at the start of the canyon. You mentioned at the opening of the show that you have about 5,000 square miles of protected area now in this monument. But you know, if you think about last year, the Obama administration set aside 730,000 square miles around Hawaii. Mm-hmm. This is a very small area in comparison, and it's only three canyons. I'll say I'm not an advocate in any way. My goal as a scientist is to provide the data by which decision makers can make their best decisions. But there's three canyons here that of 90 that exist from the Canadian border down to North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
So it's and the two fisheries that are really impacted are the red crab fishery and the lobster fishery.
Right.
And those actually have 7 years before they have to move on to some other area if they're fishing in this area. So I'm not advocating either way, but we have to keep it in perspective that we now have, scientists have, a strong desire to understand how these ecosystems are functioning and how they work. And
well, if I could just jump in here, I'm sorry, Mr. Shank, because we are going to speak to a red crab fisherman in just a moment, but I do want to sneak in one more question to you, because I actually understand that you're at a symposium about deep sea corals this very day.
Yes. Well, I'm actually hosting the 6th International Symposium on Deep Sea Corals right here in Boston.
Right here in Boston. So what are other researchers at the symposium saying about today's declaration?
It was announced this morning at our opening ceremonies. And I think there's a general agreement that it was a good thing. And I think it's because it means that our public, who's called out for this, and our government is supporting us understanding these ecosystems, these canyons and seamounts much, much more.
Well, Tim Shank is a scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Mr. Shank, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, today's declaration and the impact that it could potentially have on New England fishermen was very much on President Obama's mind. When he made his announcement today, he said that the declaration would help protect fragile ecosystems in the Atlantic Ocean, and that would help make oceans more resilient to climate change.
And this will help fishermen better understand the changes that are taking place that will affect their livelihood. And we're doing it in a way that respects the fishing industry's unique role in New England's economy and history.
So for a response, let's turn to one of those fishermen. He's John Williams. He's president of the Atlantic Red Crab Company, which is based in New Bedford. He's also president of the New England Red Crab Harvesters Association. He's currently out to sea, and he joins us via satellite phone, so there may be a slight delay. But Mr. Williams, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. First of all, you heard that little bit of tape from the president saying that today's creation of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument would actually be to the benefit of fishermen in the long run. What do you say to that?
I think I'm going to reserve comment on that, to be honest with you. I would prefer that the process went through the public process the way that all other fishery management did. This is not a good day for the fishing industry. It's not a good day for regular fishing industry.
Mr. Williams, your satellite phone is pretty shaky, so I'm going to just repeat a little bit of what I heard you say, that you would have preferred if this process had gone through a public process and not necessarily the use of an executive order. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, and that this is a tough day for fishermen, according to you?
Yeah, it's a very tough day for the industry. Very tough day for me.
So can you tell me in more detail what impact this is going to have on your company?
Well, I mean, they obviously, as I said before, they gave us 7 years before we leave, so the situation isn't dire, or they wouldn't have given us 7 years before we had to get out. They've referred to the places being, or the monument areas being pristine many, many times. The fishing industry's been active in there for 40 years. So if we can be active in a place for 40 years and still have it pristine, I think that we're fishing in a pretty eco-friendly manner.
Yeah. So again, just to jump in here, because the sat phone is a little bit shaky here. You reminded us that today's declaration gives red crab fishermen 7 years before they have to stop fishing in the area, and that you said that you've already been fishing around there for 40 years and have maintained pristine and healthy stocks. But let me ask you, how healthy are the stocks of red crab right now?
The health is, they're certainly certified as sustainable. We haven't seen any impact. Every scientist, every stock assessment scientist out there says that there is absolutely no impact on stock, on our fishery. The one comment that I would like to make, because the president didn't make, and, there's no oil, there's no everything, but there were concessions made, and there's going to be cables laid through there for here on out, and they're going to be towing these giant sea plows through this place that weigh over 200 tons right through these coral beds. So somebody is telling, they should at least tell it's not going to be, completely untouched area. We're going to be turning this place upside down and laying cables in there still.
Mr. Williams, again, let me just repeat what you said, so I'm sure we heard you right because of the satellite phone that you're on, that you say there were concessions made in the creation of the Marine Monument and that they will be allowing cables to be laid across the monument?
The White House will not comment on it when I ask them, so yes, I would say there's concessions made, so cables will continue to be laid, so sea plows will still continue to work in that area, plowing and burying cables into these areas it's probably the most invasive activity that's out there today is going to be allowed to remain.
Right. Well, so we'll check more on that. But Mr. Williams, before we lose your line here, I just want to ask you kind of a bigger, broader question here. Do you see a way to accomplish two important goals for New England and for the United States at the same time, to preserve these wonderful marine ecosystems for science and for the future, both for the future of the country and future for fishermen as well, but also provide a concurrent opportunity for fishermen to make a living?
I do. Go through the public process that we already have 52,000 square miles of protected bottom for coral on the East Coast. And that's gone through the public process that didn't have to go through an executive order. And 52,000 square miles of protected bottom is a lot, but that allowed everybody to participate rather than just a few people in a closed door.
Well, John Williams is president of the Atlantic Red Crab Company based out of New Bedford. He's currently aboard his boat in the Atlantic Ocean at sea, speaking to us over a satellite phone. Mr. Williams, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you for your time.
Again, the two views there of today's creation of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument off the coast of Cape Cod. Let us know what you think. Send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Earlier this week, there was that splashy headline. U.S. Census Bureau announces a big jump in median household income, up 5.2%, the first big increase since the Great Recession. The subhead, however, is a little more sobering. Wages are still lagging behind where they were before the year 2000. And when it comes to the Massachusetts economy, the picture here is even more complicated. A new analysis released today shows that Bay State workers didn't enjoy that 5.2% bump. So the Boston Globe's policy writer Evan Horowitz crunched the numbers, and he joins us now with more. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so start with the big picture here. How much did median income in Massachusetts rise?
2%.
2%?
Yeah, roughly half of the national average in this other survey. And it's disappointing because, you know, you live in Massachusetts, you come to expect a certain elevated functioning. You expect the state to do better than everywhere else, and we ended up doing worse.
Okay, so that's significantly worse, actually. Break down the numbers a little further here. I see that you've got analysis that male workers barely saw any increase in income.
So this, for me, was really the bleakest part of the picture. Female earnings for full-time, year-round workers in the state went up about close to 2%. Male earnings, 0.1%. It was basically flat. And everywhere else in the country, men and women both enjoyed a raise of about 2.5%. So 0.1% for men, it's pretty distressing.
And again, is this the median income?
That's the median income for full-time male workers.
Okay, so basically it didn't rise at all. No change.
That's exactly right.
Do you have an explanation or a thought as to why that might be?
Well, I wish I could say it was just a blip and maybe things will turn around, but it's actually been like this now for at least the last 7 or 8 years. Men are seeing smaller gains than women by substantial amounts, and it's probably connected to some broader shift in the economy having to do with jobs available for men, more pressure to be highly educated where women have an advantage.
And this is, again, one of those sort of, it's a stark contrast or the ironies of Massachusetts, right? Because half the time we're talking about, you know, Boston's innovation economy, but then also the other half the time we're talking about how other cities and towns and regions across the state are lagging here. I mean, was there a regional difference or was this sort of an average across the state?
It is an average across the state, but it's happening everywhere. This is not like things are going perfectly well in Boston and not so well elsewhere. No, statewide you're seeing this problem. And the more general problem of men's wages stagnating has been happening nationwide for some time.
Right. Okay. So then at the same time, we also have these other competing numbers as well. The State Executive Office of Labor and Workforce Development announced just today that the unemployment rate in Massachusetts fell in August to 3.9%, the lowest in 15 years.
That's an unbelievable low number. And, you know, you can look for sort of caveats, but there aren't any. I mean, sometimes I prefer looking at a simpler number, which is just how many people have jobs? Out of every 100 people, how many have jobs? And that went up, too. You know, the labor market looks really strong. That should translate into wage gains for everybody, and yet somehow, at least in 2015, it didn't seem to.
Okay, well, the money must be going somewhere, but we got to figure that out. I mean, are there any positive economic developments that you've gleaned from the Census Bureau's numbers for Massachusetts?
Sure, going up 2% is better than going down 2%, which is what we were doing for a couple of years during
true.
The recession, and we should take that. There are some groups, I mean, one interesting sort of good news, bad news story is with Hispanic households. So the ratio of earnings for the median Hispanic household in Massachusetts to the median non-Hispanic white household is the worst in the country. That is, relative to their white peers, Hispanic households in the state make 50 cents on the dollar.
Half.
That's the bad, maybe terrible news. The good news is they saw the biggest gains last year. Hispanic households saw bigger median wage gains than any other racial or ethnic group. So good news?
I guess. I mean, if your earnings are so low, a relatively small absolute dollar value is a larger percentage value, right?
It's still, I mean, it was dramatic. It was a 10% increase. You know, you asked to look for good news. That's a bit of good news, I think.
Okay. Well, I'm going to drag us back to the not so good news part, because I'm seeing that Massachusetts also didn't do as well as the rest of the country on average in reducing poverty.
No, we did absolutely nothing on reducing poverty. The poverty rate didn't change really in a statistically significant way, whereas nationwide it did. It dropped almost a full percentage point. So no, poverty didn't change. Incomes went up a little bit. It was really a disappointing portrayal of the state of the economy in Massachusetts, and surprisingly disappointing.
Well, Evan Horowitz is a policy writer for the Boston Globe. He wrote about the Census Bureau's household income survey data specifically for Massachusetts in today's Globe. We have a link to his article at our website, radioboston.org. Evan, thanks so much for giving us a real snapshot, both good and sobering, on the Massachusetts economy. Thanks again.
Anytime.
Well, so again, that is the current snapshot on Massachusetts wages. But let's, for a second, project into the hypothetical future. Labor activists have long been calling for a $15 per hour minimum wage. It's happened in other places, most notably in California. So what if it happened here? Whom would it really affect? I guess another way of asking is, who in New England right now earns less than $15 an hour? Well, Anmol Chadha is a policy analyst at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and he recently tried to answer that question. And he came up with a remarkable picture of who the low-wage earners in New England actually are. And he joins us now. Anmol Chadha, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks.
Okay, so bear with me for a second, or entertain me for a moment here. If I were to ask you to paint a composite picture of who the less than $15 an hour earner in New England is right now, who would that person be?
Right. So I think there's a few things here. First is there's a lot of them. So I think we found on average, or roughly across New England, about one-third of all workers make less than $15 an hour. Massachusetts is comparable. It's about 30%. So just in Massachusetts, that's about 760,000 workers who currently make less than $15 an hour. We also found that it's not really who you might expect. Mm-hmm. So a lot of sort of assumptions and preconceptions that people might have about who low-wage workers are, who minimum wage policies might affect. Most of the workers who make less than $15 an hour actually work full-time. The majority of them are the primary earners in their families, so they provide more than half of the income for their families. They're older than people expect. Often people think of like teenagers or people just starting out in the labor market.
Right, because we're always thinking of part-time jobs, summer jobs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the median age for workers who make less than $15 an hour across the economy is someone in their mid-30s.
Mid-30s.
Right, exactly. Okay. And we were even surprised in terms of education. Overall, the workforce that makes less than $15 an hour is, on average, has lower levels of education than the rest of the workforce, but a solid chunk of them actually have college degrees.
So
about one in five, that's exactly right.
In New England. So 20% of them in New England.
Yep.
Well, so this is really interesting because right there, just in that little stew of numbers, it seems as if you've debunked several preconceived notions, as you said, of who these low-wage workers are. I mean, they're working full-time. You also found that the majority of them are actually the primary wage earners in their family?
Yeah, that's right. And also a good number of them are parents as well. So we found one in five children across New England has a parent, at least one parent, who makes $15 an hour or less.
Okay. And also the numbers in terms of where these workers are, because I mean, you looked across New England, but then you also looked in various cities. I was amazed to find that in Boston, 33% of workers, according to your analysis, earn less than $15 an hour. It's even higher in other places. In Providence, 52%?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there is some variation across within the region, within the states, between cities, and then also, of course, between different demographic groups within these places.
Okay.
So African-American and Latino workers, for example, are disproportionately likely to make less than $15 an hour.
Significantly so. Tell us more about that.
Significantly so. Actually, in a number of states, the majority of Black or Latino workers make less than $15 an hour. So in Massachusetts, that's the case for Latino workers.
The majority of them,
that's right.
Okay, and also I just want to just jump up to Maine here for a second, because of all workers in Maine, of all of them, you found that, 43% earn less than $15 an hour?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, again, there's going to be differences in sort of variation across. The economies of Maine are, you know, maybe different than what's happening in Massachusetts, and the cost of living may be lower and things like that, but that's still a striking number. I mean, that's when people debate minimum wage policies, there's, I think, this idea that it's either a small percentage of workers, it's very low wage workers, it's young workers, people with very low levels of education and low skills who may eventually move up into up a job ladder into better paying jobs. But you know, this in terms of proposing a $15 minimum wage, we're talking about a large section of the labor force.
Okay, so I guess I have to ask you, what conclusions do we draw then of the potential effectiveness or efficacy if such a wage were to come to New England?
Yeah, well, so there's a big debate. There's these debates that happen around minimum wage policies, and there's two sides to the debate. So there's critics of the minimum wage would suggest that raising wages would reduce employment, as the cost of employment or hiring workers goes up, they'll hire fewer workers. In terms of the empirical evidence, it's a much more complicated picture, and there's actually a lot of the research now is showing that when they study actual increases in the minimum wage, they found little to no effect on employment. And these are consistent findings that are actually quite hard to ignore, and now I think there's this emerging consensus, especially among economists, that even though the simple economic models would suggest, like what people may learn in their Econ 101 class, for example, right, that price goes up, so people would hire fewer workers, that the real economy is actually a little bit more complicated. And there's probably a number of explanations for why that happens.
Yeah. You know, I want to acknowledge that since you work at the Boston Fed, that you can't actually say anything specifically regarding specific policy proposals. But I actually just want to instead quote the chair of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, because just last month in Jackson Hole at a Fed symposium, at the end of a speech, she actually talked about possibilities outside of monetary policy in terms of strengthening productivity and the economy. And she mentioned many possibilities, including improving our educational system, investing in worker training, promoting capital investment, research spending, et cetera, et cetera. And she was looking at basically, I think she was talking to Congress and saying these are important goals. Should Janet Yellen be also nudging the people when it comes to wages?
Well, I'm not here to tell Janet Yellen what she should be saying and what she should be doing, but I do think there is it sort of highlights the importance of looking not just at the quantity of jobs that are being created, but now it's increasingly important to consider the quality of these jobs as well. So, you know, whenever there's new job numbers that come out, that's what the focus is on, right? The number of jobs are up, the number of jobs are low, and people respond to that. But I think there's this growing recognition that we also need to be concerned with what kinds of jobs are we creating. So there's been a lot of good news that's been coming out over the last few years around job creation. Yeah. And I think, there is this growing concern around, are these well-paying jobs? Are these jobs that actually provide a ladder up? Is there mobility within these jobs? Can somebody working full-time at these jobs provide for their family?
Yeah.
And currently, with the federal minimum wage, for example, a worker working full-time, 40 hours a week, their annual income would actually be below the poverty level for a family, yeah, for a parent and one child.
Well, I do want to note that the minimum wage in Massachusetts is $10 right now, yeah, scheduled to rise to $11 in 2017. But you have painted a very compelling picture here. I mean, a third of workers in New England earning less than $15 an hour, one in five children having a parent working at that rate, most of them being full-time workers, 20% being college graduates. And of course, we've talked about the disproportionate number of African-American Latino workers who are earning these low wages. But last question for you. I mean, yes, you work at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and this report is very factual. It's very numbers-based. But I got to ask, what compelled you to even ask this question in the first place? I mean, you've actually painted a very human picture of those people who are earning less than $15 an hour. Why did you want to do this?
Sure. I think there has been, as you know, over the last few years, there's been this growing public attention and concern with inequality more broadly. Within the region, Boston was identified as having the most unequal city in the United States. Massachusetts is recognized as one of the most unequal states in the country. So there is this growing concern around issues of inequality. This is the proposals around the $15 minimum wage, as you mentioned, have been approved in other states. It's getting more and more attention. It's on the table in terms of policy discussions. One of the major parties, I think, adopted it as part of their official platform. And so we have a role in terms of providing information to people in the region, whether it's policymakers and the broader public, about providing information that can inform economic policy. So this is a growing issue of concern to people, and that's something that that we have a role to play in as well. And I also just mentioned, we had mentioned differences within the state and between cities, and the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center also released a really detailed report on who the minimum wage increase would affect within Massachusetts and different cities.
Well, I'm all for putting actual faces to who might be impacted by public policy. Anmol Chadha is a policy analyst at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. He's the author of a brief that's titled A $15 Minimum Wage in New England, Who Would Be Affected? We've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This presidential election has turned over just about every musty American electoral tradition, so why not another? Yesterday, the New Hampshire Union Leader made its official endorsement for the 2016 general election, and the paper picked Libertarian Gary Johnson. It's the first time in 100 years that the Union Leader has not picked the Republican nominee. The paper in its endorsement boldly states, quote, Americans are being told that we have to choose the lesser of two evils. No, we don't. Well, we're joined now by the editor of the editorial page of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Grant Bossy. Grant Bossy, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So breaking a century-old tradition with the Union Leader can't be something that your paper takes lightly. Why did you do this?
Well, you know, we just want to shake people up every century or so. zig when they think we're going to zag. The way we look at it, we endorse the only Republican on the ballot. Gary Johnson had 8 years as a Republican governor in New Mexico. He was very successful. Bill Weld, 8 years as a tax-fighting governor in the great state of Massachusetts, which is hard enough to do, and he was successful at it. Compared to the two New York liberals that the two major parties have given us, we picked the conservative choice, and we think that's the best bet for New Hampshire voters.
Now, the editorial, the endorsement is written with, I have to say, some classic Union Leader verve of Hillary Clinton. Basically, you write, the paper writes that the choice America faces today is between a selfish, self-centered, sanctimonious prig and Donald J. Trump. But then it goes on to say that Trump is in no way qualified to lead this nation. Quote, the man is a liar, a bully, and a buffoon. I mean,
fact check true.
Well, but tell me, though, I mean, how is this going over in New Hampshire?
Reaction, I think some people just, they're surprised that that we lived up to our word. That we've been saying for months, we've been saying before the New Hampshire First in the Nation primary, that Donald Trump is unfit for office, and we're not going to endorse him. And I think a lot of people just figured, you know, we'd get in line and be part of the team and just endorse the guy with an R after his name. That's never been what we're about. And in almost every case, we happen to agree with the Republican, certainly at the presidential level, more often than the Democrat. In this case, we couldn't find enough difference between the two major party candidates to recommend either of them, particularly not when there's a perfectly honorable alternative on the ballot in all 50 states and the District of Columbia.
Well, so let me ask you, though, when you said that people assumed that you'd, as you just said, get in line and follow the team, has there been anyone pushing back on you saying that by not doing that and by endorsing Johnson— I mean, I'm not sure how much an endorsement actually matters in the general election, but that you're effectively supporting the person who you called a selfish, self-centered, sanctimonious prig, Hillary Clinton.
I've been told that a vote or an endorsement for Gary Johnson is an endorsement of Hillary Clinton. I've also been told that an endorsement of Gary Johnson is effectively an endorsement of Donald Trump. So I think he should get all the votes, you know, whether you want Clinton, Trump, or Johnson. Apparently voting for Johnson's the same thing, so why not mention him? Look, he's the best choice in our minds to be president. If the other two were acceptable, we probably wouldn't look to the third-party option. It's a really hard hill to climb for a third-party candidate to win. Mm-hmm. He's got to cobble together the coalition of Americans that doesn't like Donald Trump and doesn't trust Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
That's
a
pretty big block of votes. If he can get them to know he's there, that he's throwing them a lifeline, he could win. Now he's absolutely got to get into the debates this fall to let people know that he's a real option when they walk into the polling booth. Yeah.
You know, there's people who've been following the story of the union leader for a while know that there is no love lost between the paper, the editorial side of the paper, and Donald Trump. I mean,
Don't think he liked it when we called him Biff from Back to the Future.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to December of last year. He called your paper dishonest, failing, going down the tubers. He said you'd be out of business in 2 years. So I don't think he's shedding a tear that he didn't get
in. So, you know, we've only got 18 months left. We're going to make the most of it.
I don't think he's shedding a tear that he didn't get your endorsement. But in the last few seconds that we have, Grant, I wonder if you think that more newspapers, I mean, some in Texas have done this, but should take the principled stand that you have the union leader taking.
We think that people that want a conservative limited government president should look at the only conservative limited government candidate, and that, you know, voting to stop one candidate by electing another unacceptable candidate is a short-sighted strategy. So give Gary Johnson a look, let him into the debates. What are you afraid of? We think that would absolutely be the best option for voters in New Hampshire and, quite frankly, in every state.
Well, Grant Bossy is the editor of the editorial page for the New Hampshire Union Leader. Great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Anytime. Thank you.
Today in Boston's Chinatown, a dozen long-absent residents have returned. They are men and women, grandparents and professors, workers and small children who haven't seen the bricks and banners of Chinatown for 50, 60, even 100 years. The people are, in fact, life-sized images from Chinatown's past. A remarkable new art installation, 12 historical photos enlarged, transferred to wooden sheets, and lovingly hand-painted by 80-year-old artist Wen T. Sen. And Sen says the figurines have come home. The installation is called Hometown, representing Boston's Chinatown as a place of people then and now. But of course, this is a rapidly changing home today. Chinatown is quickly gentrifying, which is why Sen says, as modern-day Bostonians walk around the Chinatown installation today, coming eye to eye with the faces from the past, he hopes people will take in their existence, see how the neighborhood has changed, see them with sisterly and brotherly empathy, and notice their historical lives. We met Wen T. Sen and some of his evocative wooden cutouts right under the Chinatown gate earlier today, and we started with a cutout of a little boy and girl.
It's a boy and a girl, and I think the boy looks like about 4 years old, mm-hmm. and the girl maybe 2 years older. And it was from a picture that was taken, I assume, in the early 40s.
Was this photograph taken in Boston?
Yeah, actually, just down the street, where they live. In fact, these are two people who later grew into sort of very important people in the community. One is Reggie Wong, and the other one is Catherine Wong, I think. And they were kind of the pillars of the community. When you look at the little boy, about 4 years old, and you look at his face, that's what fascinated me.
Well, so the title of the installation is Hometown.
Yeah, right.
Right? And you're representing, I love that, yeah. Boston's Chinatown as a place of people.
Yes.
So what is the story of these two children, of the Wong children? Tell us.
Well, the reason I use the hometown as two separate words, right, because one's association, I think in hometown America, USA, or hometown USA, has a certain quality that is like almost like a Midwestern, you know, town with lawns in the front, But I'm trying to say is, actually, Chinatown itself is a home to a lot of people. And it's been here for, the whole idea is that it's been here for over 100 years. And so the home, in that sense, is much wider than the geographic area
yeah.
of Chinatown. But so that it becomes the home of all the Chinese Americans in the New England yeah. kind of thing.
Well, can we walk to another part of the installation here, just down the road a little bit? Why did you want to do this now?
This home that we're talking about is actually being threatened, well, for many, for the last 30 years or something like that, by different kind of expansion of the city. Urban renewal in the 1960s.
Yeah, in the mid-20th century,
yeah,
right.
Which is, was the, you know, they built highways mm-hmm. and demolishing. And a lot of the inner city at that time was, you know, devalued.
Yeah.
So they say Chinatown especially was kind of devalued in the sense that there's not much political power at the city hall. So they look at this thing as a derelict place that we can, you know, use it to renew the city. And then now it's a whole new situation.
Gentrification.
Right, exactly. And that is because that was in the 80s. People were gathering together after with a lot of newcomers from China who are younger people who are college educated. They would become activists saying that the community does not have to be like a ghetto ruling themselves, that they can actually get services from the city. But high-rise is a different situation, luxury buildings, and that's the economic thing. When you have a block that has three-story, four-story buildings that rent for a few hundred dollars, that people have been living there for 50 years or something, when you have offers of building 50-story high buildings with the top floor for several million dollars, then the temptation to sell was very, very great.
Well, let's... We're right next to this other figure here. Again, these are all life-size now.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
So here we have the image of a man. He's wearing, is it a bow tie? Mm-hmm. He's quite smartly dressed.
Yes.
A nice little hat and a walking stick as well. Who is he?
I love him. I guess he was taking a photo from a picnic in Maine in the early 20th century. So they tried to learn... become Americans, Americanized at that time. And he was obviously had a pretty good tutor who got him into a very smart dress and a rose on his
skirt. I was going to say, he's even got the rose on his buttonhole.
Yes, right, yeah. So actually what I'm trying to capture is there was a kind of pride in his appearance. So that there's a kind of, it's a black and white photo, but I also try to recreate the kind of feeling that people used to have of coloring photographs in the Civil War and things like that.
Now, is there another one? Oh, there's that one there. We'll take a look at that one. It occurs to me, I know there are 12 figures total mm-hmm. in the installation. Where did you find the photographs, first of all?
It's with the Chinese Historical Society of New England, who is the partner for the project.
And were you able to find pictures of people at work?
That's the trouble, actually. It's rather difficult. Because all the pictures are of people who are in a position of more or less power, that they are put into that, and it's a very strongly oriented to a patriarchal society.
You were able to find a picture of a laundryman?
Yes. I would love to look at the talk about the laundryman,
yes,
actually.
Yes, please.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's so interesting because walking around here, and the fact that you made them life-sized and have colorized the images as well. I mean, almost as if it feels like they are here with us.
Right.
It's like ghosts of Chinatown brought to
exactly,
life.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Actually, for me, it's actually two things. One was, there's a funeral quality of bringing back ghosts. But by colorizing them, I almost make them alive so that they are relating to us as the real people.
Well, let's go talk about the laundryman.
Yes. Oh, I'd love to take a picture of that. Sorry, it's a monk who are looking at the... Do you mind if I...
Oh, no, please, go ahead. So we're headed towards one of the figures in the installation. It's the image of the laundryman. And right now there's a... Looks like he's a Buddhist monk standing in front of the image. He's dressed in his orange robes and sandals, and he's this shaved head, and he's reading the placard describing what the laundryman figure is all about.
This guy, his name is Yuk Guang Dong. He was the last one that I found. In fact, I couldn't find him. Couldn't find any working people, as you mentioned earlier, in the books and things like that. By all his portrait, he looked like a rather small person. But I made him to in between so that he's about my size now, but I think he might have been 5'2" or something like that. And his gesture, everything is so very contained. It has that show that his whole hard life. And for me, he represents all the hard work that the Chinese laundryman has gone through in all those years. And that's why when I put in his eyes and looking at us, it's like kind of a quality of his humanity that has come through, that we're relating to each other.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about his demeanor and his posture in the image, it's true. His hands are sort of crossed just below his waist.
Yes.
And he's wearing, looks like, very simple clothes. Just a jacket and pants and a white shirt.
It does look like... but when I looked at him in total, he has a hat on that is a little bit... sort of like a second-hand clothing store, a kind of cap from a sort of leftover from a Harvard student. And his whole clothes is rather unfitting. At the same time, he's creased and his shoes are polished.
Yeah.
And I think it was his Sunday best. He actually, the shop is very interestingly, it's in Blue Hill Avenue, if you know Boston.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the poorest districts. I think at that time there was a certain amount of Asian immigrants there,
yeah.
Chinese immigrants.
Well, Wen-Ti, do you mind if I ask you, clearly, as we've been walking down the path here and seeing your work and hearing you talk, this idea of home,
mm-hmm.
it's obvious that it's so very important to
right.
you. Not just for the Asian American community here in Boston, but I wonder, what does home mean to you? Because your own life has been one of a global travel, whether you wanted it to be or not.
When I grew up in China, I had home for 3 or 4 years. That was a real home that I love, but then it was never there because of just your revolution, Second World War, and all that stuff. And then we'll move from our home to another city, and then to another country, to Paris, London, and things like that. So home became the part that I carry within me. So being a Chinese, I find that home is a visionary thing within, and my home is different to another Chinese American's home. That's why I feel that hometown, like Chinatown, in a way, create that feeling of being, we have certain amount of things together. It wasn't until when I was 50 years old and start painting one of the murals to protest one of the gentrification, the development thing, that I got to be working with people in Chinatown. And I did find a kind of a home here, because of affinity.
Now, I think you're actually being a little humble in terms of your own family story and your story, because, as you said, you had to leave China after the Second World War, right?
After the revolution.
After the revolution.
Yeah.
And then your family moved to France and
right.
England?
Yeah, I was. My mother was educated in France.
Yeah.
When the revolution came, it became a rather natural thing for her to go back to Paris,
right.
which is my my loveliest time. I was 13, 14, and what can you lose when you're 13, 14 in Paris? And then I was sent to school in London, which was our post-Second World War London. Was not a very nice place.
And then when did you come to the United States?
My brother started teaching in Boston, and my mother, she got her to come, and my second brother, and I was left in Europe in an art school for 2 years. And I was in art school in Europe, you don't have to do very much. You can just go and look at things.
So you have been an immigrant then multiple times.
Yes.
Different
yes.
countries, different
right.
different eras and in different ways. I mean, what has your immigrant experience meant to you?
I think aside from these public art things, my own paintings deals with that experience. What it is, I think, being an immigrant, you have several layers of yourself. They're all selves. Again, it's like a home. You have several homes inside you, and you can present, open up these different doors to these different homes to show people. But there are about 10 different homes in your life that you do not show the person that you are with. So when I'm in Chinatown, I will open one door and I'm when I'm in another place, and you know, in Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, I'll open quite different doors. It's to show that layering of, I think, is really kind of wonderful. That it's only in America in that sense that you can have that. That you, because in Europe, like a Frenchman is a Frenchman, an immigrant is an immigrant, no outsider. Whereas in America, you can be an American and an immigrant too.
Well, thank you so much for opening these doors here to the immigrant experience of the people's images who you've brought back to life with the hometown installation. Right. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Magnus. Thank you very much.
That's artist Wen T. Sen. Such a charming man. He walked us through his new installation, Hometown, Representing Boston's Chinatown as a Place of People, Then and Now. It's on display until Sunday. Now, about that now part, this Saturday afternoon, Sen is setting up an interactive photo session under the Chinatown Gate, and he wants today's Bostonians to visit and have their picture taken as part of the exhibit. We've got more information about that at radioboston.org. That's it for today. We'll leave you with some more sounds from just under the Chinatown Gate. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.